Welcome to the Moose Room. Brad and Emily are here today. Finally, we're back together. It's been a while since the both of us have podcasted together, but we're back again, and glad to be back on this beautiful fall day. Today, we have some special guests. Like I had said before, we went out and we're trying to learn about lots of different things in the dairy world and the beef world. Today, we got some guests to talk about colostrum. And today we're going to be talking with Pete Erickson. He's a professor at the University of New Hampshire, and he specializes in calf health and calf and heifer nutrition. And he has worked on some studies with Tess Stahl, and she is assistant professor at Rutgers in New Jersey. And both of them worked on some colostrum stuff in Jersey cows. And we're here to learn about what all they did and how we can sort of alleviate some issues with colostrum feeding in cattle. And but first, we always have two super secret questions for our guests. So we'll let Emily take over.
Yes. So again, all of our guests get asked this, so our longtime listeners are used to this tradition. So I'm going to ask the question and we'll have both of you answer, and then we'll just ask the second question. So the first question, and I am going to have Pete answer this one first, is what is your favorite breed of beef cattle?
Of beef cattle?
Yes.
Angus.
Angus. All right. And Tess, what about you?
Hereford.
Hereford. All right. So Bradley is team Hereford, so I'm sure he's happy with that answer.
I should have said Limousine or something like that.
Yes, Hereford is gaining on the top leader, Angus. So let's run down our beef breed. So Black Angus still at 17 out in the lead. Hereford in second at 13. Black Baldy 5, Scottish Highlander 5, Charolais 4, Red Angus 4, Shorthorn 3, Simmental 2, Belted Galloway 2, Brahma 2, and all with one still, Stabilizer, Galvey, Kiania, Nalore, Jersey, Belgian Blue, Brangus, Piedmontese, White Park, and Miniature Scottish Highlander.
All right. So you can probably guess the second question, and we're going to have Tess answer this one first.
Well, I know the answer to this.
What is your favorite breed of dairy cattle?
Brown Swiss.
Brown Swiss. Bradley just likes anything that isn't black and white.
I love the ears. They get me with their ears every time.
Agreed. All right. Pete, what about you?
Should I do my New England accent for this or not?
Yes.
Okay. Ashier.
That is a good New England accent.
Say Ayrshire.
Well, Brown Swiss has now increased its numbers, but Holstein's still in the lead. So let's run down our dairy breeds. Holstein, 24. Jersey, the correct answer, at 20. So it's gaining.
Wow.
Brown Swiss at 12. Montbéliard, 3. Dutch Belted, 3. Guernsey, 3. Ayrshire, 3. Or Ayrshire, whatever you want to say. If you're from New England, Ayrshire. Milking Shorthorn, 2, and Normandy, 2.
All right. Well, now that we've gotten the important business out of the way, we can move on. So I know Bradley is the one who got these guests today, so I'm pretty excited. And we're going to be covering something that we haven't talked about in a while on this podcast, and that is colostrum. So Bradley, I think you're a little more familiar with the work Tess and Pete have done, so I'll maybe let you talk a little bit more about why we have them here today.
Yeah, I'm very interested in colostrum and calf health and calf nutrition. And I thought that it would be interesting to see what we could find in the world of feeding colostrum and some of the issues and challenges that are happening. So Tess, why don't you tell us a little bit how you got into the study and why you decided to focus on colostrum in dairy calves.
So yeah, when I was starting my doctorate, I found the paper from Gavin So that was Journal of Dairy Science, I think 2018. And the work was from Washington State Veterinary School. The cows were in Texas, and they did this prospective study, 2,500 Jerseys throughout a year, and just were measuring colostrum production and colostrum quality and trying to parse in on some things that might be affecting it. So that really sparked my interest in this subject area. And, you know, at the University of New Hampshire, we're blessed to have two dairy farms. So the conventional dairy, the Fairchild Dairy Farm, has Holsteins, and then the organic, the Burley Demerit Farm, has Jerseys. And so it was kind of convenient that we could start looking into this problem using the Jerseys that we had at UNH.
So experiment one revolved around feeding niacin, specifically the nicotinic acid version of niacin, based off of some work I did actually for my doctorate a long time ago at Illinois. And we had seen that the response was for increase in milk protein and so on and so forth. And I got approached by a company to look at it around the state on some commercial farms. Didn't work out very well, and I had some extra cash left over, and they said I could use it for a study. So based off of what nicotinic acid does, it's a vasodilator, so it increases blood flow. And during when we're making colostrum, we need more blood to flow to the mammary gland for nutrient uptake, number one. And number two, it looks like it actually works in the rumen. And there's some conflicting data. Does it work with high corn diets? And some of our other data says it doesn't. So anyway, we said, okay, so let's look at this in some dairy cows. Our first study, we looked at 0 or 48 grams. Now, previously, we only fed it up to 12 grams, and this was for lactating cows. Oftentimes, it's used as a control for subclinical ketosis to help with that. So we fed 48 grams, and lo and behold, we saw some improvement in colostrum quality, grams of IgG per liter. Okay, so that was one of my students' master's projects, and then she stayed on for her doctorate, Dr. Kayla Aragona. She stayed on for her doctorate with me, and we looked at 0, 16, 32, or 48 grams to Holsteins. And we saw an improvement in colostrum quality, no difference in gain at 32 grams, and then treated the calves exactly the same. And we saw an improvement in feed efficiency in these calves, especially from 0 to 3 weeks when they're getting mostly milk. So then speed ahead, all this stuff's coming out about Jerseys. And so then Tess came along, and the first experiment that she ran was looking at supplementing this to Jerseys with a difference in our DCAD diet. And they got a little murky. And I mean, she and I are in the process of submitting these papers now. But one thing that was fascinating was that we saw an improvement in xylose uptake. Okay, so what's this? Xylose is a marker for intestinal development. So the higher the xylose is in the blood, the more intestinal development. So basically, calves that were born of cows fed nicotinic acid, in this case, the Jerseys were getting 23 grams, had more xylose uptake. So something happened with the intestinal development. The interesting thing about this study was that of the 41 calves that were born to the 40 cows, only 31 could be used because their mothers did not make enough colostrum or any colostrum.
So you have some of these cows that are not producing any colostrum at all.
Yeah.
We had one that made nothing.
That's one thing we might not hear of. I see it once in a while in our university dairy herd here where some cows, they just don't have any colostrum, and it just baffles me and everybody else, like, what is going on here? Why does this cow have no milk?
I believe it's a bigger problem actually with Holsteins.
Really?
based off of some data from New York, and they did a big study on New York dairies, and it was like 12% of the Holsteins in that study. I might be wrong. I believe it's 12% did not produce any colostrum. You know, so all this kind of goes together with this lack of colostrum production. Why does this happen? And which your initial question about, you know, why we did this big, huge study with farms from across the country, you know, this was kind of the, you know, basically kind of that in the study from Washington State with the cows in Texas kind of put it all together and made some sense to try to figure out. And I think we ended up with a pretty neat model based off of what we looked for. And I'll let Tess handle that because this is her baby. So
yeah. So let's talk about your study. So you went and collected data from 28 farms all over the U.S. That's a lot. You know, that's a pretty good number of farms. So it's not like we're dealing with one farm, you know, having to say, well, we have no colostrum yield. And then, the neighbor says, well, I don't have a problem. So you're looking at a lot of farms all over the U.S. How did you go about collecting all of this fun data?
I started cold emailing, cold calling, cold asking all these farms, any farm that I could find on the Jersey directory and personal contacts of Pete's or other researchers that were contacts of Pete's to get us some farms that we could enroll. We did actually luckily have one herd that was an organic that I didn't ask. They reached out to us. That was exciting. So there was word getting around within the Jersey producers.
The herd sizes ranged from 30 cows to 6,000 cows. So, you know, these are not, you know, all the same size. There's this issue is being seen by no matter what herd size you have. So it's quite interesting that you have small herds and large herds and the organic herd. That's always good too.
It was really good. I mean, I think that's one of the strongest points of the study is the range and herd sizes. You know, a lot of the herds, obviously, we're from the Northeast, we're in the Northeast. But we did go as far west as Idaho, Texas, and South Carolina. And we had some university herds, four or five universities, college herds, you know, and we had a USDA herd.
So, you know, the thing I'm kind of curious about and you know, on-farm research, I think, is always so fun, you know, because you actually get to be where it's being applied. You know, but I'm just curious. I'm a big, like, you know, I love the quantitative data, but I also love qualitative data. And so I'm just wondering, you know, anecdotally, maybe, what did you learn along the way? You know, what these farmers knew what you were coming to study, and I'm sure they had some thoughts and ideas and concerns. So I'm kind of curious from the farmer perspective, you know, were there some, you know, similar concerns you were kind of hearing from everybody, or did everybody kind of have a different situation they were working through? You know, just, yeah, like Brad, I'm really impressed by the variety of farms and variety of sizes. And so I'm kind of curious what you heard from this wide variety.
It was really interesting. Herds that had like multiple breeds. So you have a Jerseys and Holsteins. We don't have a problem. And then they started measuring. It's like, oh, we have a problem because, okay, the cow didn't make colostrum. You had your colostrum in the freezer and you use that. And that was, but when they started looking at it, then it became, oh, wow, this is a thing. So.
And there was a herd in Maryland too. The producer, when I had contacted her, she said, well, we measure in bottles and I always have enough to feed the calf. I said, okay. You know, that's great. Well, we want any farms that have the issue, farms that hopefully don't, all are great. And then halfway through the study, she called me and she said, you know, once I started weighing it, I did notice the drop. It wasn't enough to, and I think she still had enough to feed the calves, but it was enough to make her say, wow, this does happen. So that was big for us to say, yeah, okay, even if you don't have the issue affecting your pooled amount of colostrum or your stored amount of colostrum, you can see that it still happens.
We maybe don't think about that a lot because just like this farmer said, oh, well, I have enough to feed, you know, the calves, so I don't really perceive it to be an issue as long as I have enough. But sometimes having just the right amount is maybe not enough.
Yeah. I mean, for producers, colostrum replacer is great, but it does miss the bioactive compounds that are in maternal colostrum that help with calf development. So they do miss out on a little bit by not having maternal.
So you really tried to figure out what was the cause of either no colostrum or low colostrum, but you also measured you measured yield, but you measured the quality of it as well. So
right.
You have
right.
both of these yes. things. Just because a cow produces 40 pounds of colostrum doesn't mean that it's any good.
Well, right. And that's why like time, you know, we in the paper, we actually spoke and said time of harvest can be misleading because if you waited 8 hours, you might get a lot of colostrum, but is it really colostrum? Which actually gets to the root of the whole thing.
And we had a herd that collected, I think, at 24 or 25
30,
hours.
32.
Yeah.
That was a, oops, that calf was born on the weekend.
Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. You should not be feeding your calf 32 hours after the calf is born. So what are the key components that you found in your studies that contribute to increased colostrum yield in these cows?
The bigger the herd, the lower the colostrum yield. But it was such a small amount, so not much. Another one that came in was ordinal day, and again, very low contribution. Latitude was interesting. The further north you are, the less colostrum your cows make. And that was a big player. So we had a lot of herds like in northern Maine, northern Vermont, right, at, you know, 45 degree parallel. We had herds down south. And that was a big one. And it's interesting. I went to Alberta in the winter and was speaking to three groups of dairy farmers. And I asked the question and they said, yeah, well, it's a problem. Well, now we're at 50, 55 degrees north. It was a big challenge. So that was interesting. One that gets repeated all the time that has an impact, a positive impact on colostrum yield, is dry period length. The longer your dry period is, the more colostrum your cows will make. And that's been repeated time and time again. We're not talking about exorbitant, you know, if you try a 60 day and you're getting the issue, if you go up like 10 to 20 days more, that might help you out. We think it has to do with energy. Interesting thing though, cows make more colostrum when it's hot.
Really?
Yes, when it is hot. And that's been seen in other studies as well. We think it has to do with vasodilation. So more blood flow, you know, the blood, they're going to try to cool themselves. So the periphery. So blood flow. So that was kind of interesting. Time to harvest. Well, that's a little bit of a misnomer because, again, you could wait 6 hours and all of a sudden you get a lot more colostrum. But is it colostrum? Number of feedings per day. And this tended to be on your smaller herds. So, you know, 40, 50 cow herd might be feeding their dry cows a couple times a day, whereas your big herds are more than likely going to feed them once a day. And that came in. And we think, you know, chime in here, Tess, but I think it has to do with those smaller herds feeding a couple times a day, seeing the cows more, you know, being around the animals more and catching the potential. You know, we looked at photoperiod too. It didn't come into the model of interest. Photoperiod did not come into the model. But environmental temperature did, and I really think it's environmental temperature. I don't think it's photoperiod.
So it really is maybe about the cold really more so, especially in the north, when those of us are experiencing colder weather. So cold weather in the north, lower colostrum yield compared to herds that were maybe in the south and a little bit hotter.
Right, right. So one of the things that has to happen is hormonally is that at parturition, at calving, prolactin has to spike. Prolactin doesn't spike when it's cold. Okay. And that's some old data with beef heifers, not Angus beef heifers. But yeah, anyway,
right.
But it has to spike. I don't know. Maybe they are, but it has to spike. And one of the things we think that prolactin does is converts from colostrogenesis to lactogenesis. So the making of colostrum to the making of milk. And for that to happen, you need water, and prolactin might. So a study we're going to do is look at prolactin levels with environmental temperature on our two herds here. It's very interesting. Our organic herd being organic, the cows have to have access to the outside. That was where tested her first experiment. Our conventional herd is a tie-stall Holstein barn, and the cows are inside. So even on the coldest day, it's probably not much below 41 degrees, which is a lower critical temperature. So we don't see it that much with the Holsteins at this facility. So I'm thinking loose housing barns, open access, those kind of things. You know, New York's a pretty cold state, and they saw 12% of their cows not produce colostrum.
So the big question I have that I feel like our listeners are probably wondering too. So yeah, we're talking about these differences in colostrum production based on temperature, right? So when it's colder, less production. Like how much less are we talking, right? Like 20%, 50%, you know, like what, how significant is this difference in production based on temperature or weather?
The longer the dry period length, I think they dropped about half a pound for every 10 days, something like that. I think that's what it was. And so it's not huge. Unlike when it's hot, it was a lot more milk, a lot more colostrum was made. Quality, different story, but a lot more colostrum is made when it's hot. So I think, and Tess and I, and I believe she agrees with me, I think it has to do with when it's cold out, the longer the dry period is a negative effect because they're spending more time trying to maintain their core temperature, spending more nutrients trying to maintain their core temperature, and less nutrients going to the colostrum, if that makes sense. So I don't think it's not a huge number on the drop. Like again, maybe half a pound for 10 days below the thermal neutral zone of the dry period length.
It does. So here's the question, the burning question. What do we do about it? So we have low colostrum yield or no colostrum yield. What do we do to help, you know, farmers improve their yield or improve the quality of their colostrum? I know it's not an easy question. I know it's not an easy question, but people, it's always like farmers want to know how do I fix this?
We unfortunately didn't come up with things that were super concrete, you know, latitude, like when it came into the model, it's not like we can say to farms in Maine, well, just move to Texas. It's fine.
That's
you know?
Not going
to
happen.
Exactly.
We hope it doesn't happen. Or Minnesota.
Right, exactly.
But we are thinking that more focus on dry period management, more focus on maybe nutrition, because we didn't necessarily look too deeply into that. I know that Westhoff and the New York group did look a lot into nutrition, a lot more than we did. And then maybe a little, there's some indication that genetics plays into it. So there could be maybe a shift in focusing on bulls that might result in increased colostrum production. I think that's way farther down the line than anything else, but it could come up.
I think, and I might be putting all my eggs in one basket here. I think it has to do with housing. And I think that if we're going to have a cow calving, I think we need to keep her away from not quite a warm barn, but a barn where she doesn't have access to the outside, where we do the work here. They're organic jerseys, and the calving pen is wide open. The only difference between the calving pen there and the calving pen at the conventional dairy is that the conventional dairy, it's inside, it's in a tie barn. Maybe that's all it is. Because if we're talking about temperature and prolactin spikes and that, it might just be something as simple as that. I'm sure it's not. I'm sure there are other things that come into play, like Tess said. But I just dawned on me recently that this might be it, as I wrote another paper. And it's just, the herd manager's wife works in this facility here where I am. And she said, oh, we never see that. Okay. Now think about it. This is a Holstein barn, tie stalls, and you compare it to, now again, it's a small number, it's 100 cows, but you compare it to what they saw in New York, where 12% of those cows produce nothing, I believe. Those are most likely big freestall barns, access to the cold. Okay. So maybe it's as simple as that.
And even, I mean, you said that, like, the calving facility or the calving pen at the organic, technically every barn that the cows are in at our organic facility has an open front. So even like where they put the dry, far off dry cows, it's just a shelter structure.
It's a three-sided shed.
Yeah, exactly. So.
So you have in Morris, you have the crosses. And they're outside all the time, right?
Yes.
Do you have a calving barn?
They do calve in a barn, inside a barn, but it's, you know, it's warmer than the outside world, but it's still cold.
But is it, do you think it's below 41 in there, or around 41, or
no, it's probably a little bit warmer than that. Yeah.
Do you run into any problems with this?
We do when it gets colder. If we're calving, say, early December, you know, late November, or maybe in March when it can be cold, that's when we typically see it.
Because it gets a lot colder where you are than where we are. It gets cold here, but not to the extent, you know, you have it. I don't, you know, and the other thing too, when you look at the paper from Gavin, the Washington State Group, in Texas, I believe that herd was in the panhandle. Now, the temperature didn't get that cold, but it's always windy there. Is it, could it just be, could that have an effect on it? I don't know. You know, wind chill, if the barn's open. And, you know, it's down there, they're probably going to have a lot of very open facilities, I would imagine, and just speculation.
Yeah,
but
it is an interesting thought that it could be that simple. And, you know, I think if farmers are having issues with that, that might be the first thing is maybe try keep your cows inside when they're calving and see if that can help with some of the colostrum yield.
I don't know if you recall, but you and I were on a trip together in Wisconsin, and we went, and that was a 1,300 cow Holstein herd. And I asked the guy in the calf barn about his colostrum, and he said he ran out. He had none.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that.
And very well-run herd of cows. Mm-hmm. Very well-managed, top-notch operation, I thought. And it was interesting, but he said starting in November. And this was north-central Wisconsin, mid-central Wisconsin. Up around Marshfield, I believe.
Yep, it was.
So, you know.
So as we start to kind of wrap things up here, you know, I'm curious for both Pete and Tess, you know, like what's next? What's the next thing you're kind of working on with this study, or maybe what's on the wish list to look at in the future? Yeah, kind of take a look into your crystal ball for me, if you would.
There is work more so on beef cattle, I think, than there is on small ruminant. So there's probably a lot of questions unanswered with small ruminant colostrum and some pretty basic applied studies that can be done that have long since been done in dairy cattle that I hope to be able to do with sheep and goats.
So the current things we're doing is in the first study, Tess is actually on the graduate students committee, is we're looking again back at that nicotinic acid levels to see if we can increase the quality and possibly the quantity and look at the bioactives that are in it. You know, we didn't tell you, but there's some increases in bioactives in Tessa's first study in the colostrum, and that could have easily been why we saw that intestinal development thing. So that's number one. Number two, there's only been one study done on probiotics that's published in colostrum in cows, and it was actually my laboratory that did it. And we're looking at starting that with Holsteins and following the calves out to 12 weeks. It's now recommended that, you know, we used to stop at 6-8 weeks, but let's see if we can maintain that, if there's any growth benefit further out. So that's the other one.
We thank you for joining us today and teaching us all about colostrum and many different facets.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah. Em, do you want to wrap us up?
Yes, and I have a feeling that maybe sometime in the future we will be doing an episode just about prolactin. that I think is really interesting, so I could see us diving into that deeper. But, well, thank you again, Tess and Pete, for joining us today. We are going to wrap up this episode. So if you have any questions, comments, or scathing rebuttals about today's episode, you can email those to themooseroom@umn.edu. You can also call and leave us a voicemail at 612-624-3610. Find us on the web, extension.umn.edu. You can find New Hampshire Extension on the web at extension.unh.edu. And you can find Rutgers Extension on the web at njaes.rutgers.edu/extension. And that's a wrap. Bye.